All right, and we are live. Today is Thursday, February 1st, 2024. My name is Alexis Briggs Brignoni, and I'm accompanied by the never-ending meeting director, the chip of the old Buick truck block, and the person you can hide anything from if it's on a digital storage medium, the one and only Heather Charpentier. The music is Higher Up by Shane Ivers and can be found at SilvermanSound.com. Hello, Heather.
Hello. Thank you for the, as always, wonderful intro.
You know, I know you like the whole chip of the old block there.
Yeah, that's great. I look forward to every 2 weeks when I can hear what the intro of me is going to be for this podcast. Never disappoint.
Yeah, Kevin says he LOLs at the intros. And sending hi to Lori. She's up in the chat as well. And
hi, Lori.
If you're listening and you're not in the chat, just come in and participate. Yeah. So what have you been up to? What's been going on the last couple of weeks?
Nothing much. I mean, well, super busy with everything. Work is crazy, as always.
Nothing much. A whole bunch.
Yeah. So nothing much exciting, I guess. Work is really crazy. You know, same old stuff. Working on the class for IASIS with you. So other than that, nothing exciting. How about with you?
Good. Just working on some parsers that I need. So folks, be on the lookout for iLeap and ALeap. Some of the tools that I help with, open source tooling. So we do some new parsers for them in the next couple of weeks. And just busy, not as busy as you. And I'm going to share with the community. You're a really able and capable chip off person, which I respect immensely. So that's why the little inside joke there on the chip off the old block from a Buick, all those chip offs that you have. You know, you do and all that. So that's amazing. But
yeah, the vehicles are, we're really busy with chipping off vehicles. So it's been crazy.
And you know what? That's something we should be maybe do a little segment on, you know, for next episode. You know, mm-hmm. I think we should do that. We haven't really talked about cars.
Yeah, we have not. We should definitely add it.
Yeah, so we can say we talk about computers and cars. I mean, sorry, it's phones and cars.
Right.
Eventually computers.
Yeah, someday. When my coworker Kevin watches this, someday, Kevin, I promise.
Yeah, so yeah, but other than that, I mean, just doing some parsers, just working cases and the whole IASIS. If you don't know what IASIS is, it's a nonprofit educational organization that prepares individuals to become digital forensic examiners. And they have all sorts of courses, and we volunteer with them. So we're going to be teaching the advanced mobile forensics course. So there's still space. So if anybody wants to just, you know, learn a little bit from with us and from us, then go ahead and check it out.
Yeah, definitely. It's the last week of April or first week of into the first week of May. So
yeah, there's two sessions. That's why it's the two weeks. So you can take either the first week or the second week, same content both weeks. So,
and in sunny Orlando, so it's at least a nice place too.
Absolutely. Oh, I didn't put my fireworks. I had to put them later. The reactions. I need to do that. Oh, here they are. Let me put my fireworks. There we go. Oh, I put the lasers on.
That's even better. Very fancy.
All right. So so let's get into the show. The chat is lighting up. That's awesome. So what do we have? What's the first topic here?
So we are actually going to talk about Black History Month. It started today. And I'll let you start with that topic.
Yeah. So I got here a nice little logo here, Black History Matters, 365 days a year. And I love this different events and, awareness that, through every month. So this month is Black History Month. And I want to talk a little bit about some, pioneers, and hopefully we can do this throughout the month, pioneers into computing, right? And I want to bring up, let me see if I can, do you have the?
I do.
Yeah. So we're going to talk briefly about Annie Isley, all right? And she worked at NASA, her career during the 60s during the space race and all type of stuff. And you might be familiar with the context if you watch the movie, what's the movie?
Hidden Figures.
Hidden Figures, right? And it's a great movie. I think you know, we've both seen it, right?
Yeah, excellent movie.
And some of these pretty much genius women, they were literal human computers, right? The engineers would have a mathematical problem and they would do it by hand. Well, Annie Isley, the moment mechanical computers, say mechanical in the sense of, computers as we know them today, came out, she would not be left behind, right? So she went in and started coding in Fortran and SOAP and some other, languages. And her contributions to the field of, rocketry and computer science, and even into hybrid technology, hybrid, like electrical and, different energy technologies, her contributions are the foundation to many other things that we take for granted nowadays in those fields. So it's always good to, remember those that came before us, those whose shoulders we stand on, and, take them as, first of all, recognition of their importance, but also as inspiration for us to achieve even more. So for this week, Annie Isley is our person to remember. So
yeah,
there we go.
All right. So we're going to get right into some topics. So this is a topic that we talk about a lot. So and you're probably never going to stop hearing about this topic from either of us, but testing and validation when it comes to mobile devices. And I mean, the importance of testing and validation we've mentioned on this podcast numerous times, and it's such an important part of the digital forensic process. And Hexordia actually just released a blog not too long ago, and it's a walkthrough to unlocking and rooting an Android device. So it takes you through all of the steps that you need to perform in order to unlock and root an Android device and prepare it to be your test device. I really, really like this blog because it not only addresses how to do this, but it addresses the challenges that might arise during the rooting process. Anybody who's worked in digital forensics knows that there are always challenges. Something goes wrong all the time. But Hexordia, Jessica's blog, actually addresses some of those common challenges that will arise. This is one of the most detailed walkthroughs that I've seen on this topic. So did you get a chance to take a look at it?
Oh, no, absolutely. And it's worthwhile checking out. I don't know who said it. Something like, an expert is a person that has tried all the wrong ways. Something could happen until they get to the way that actually works, right? And you think somebody, that person is so knowledgeable, right? That person is a genius. Well, that person most likely committed all the mistakes there are to be committed before they get to the point they needed to be, right?
Yeah, I really like that the mistakes that they've run into are pointed out in this blog, because you don't have to go try and figure it out on your own for these mistakes. But rest assured, new errors will come through.
Yeah, and make them known so we can shortcut the process if we're following your process. Right? No, and this is important. So I'm going to give an example for the folks as they're watching and listening. So Heather, we were talking about I think it's last night. We're looking at, I think it's Google Chat, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and we're like, well, we're looking for these pictures, and where are the pictures? How can we put them into this chat that we're looking at to make a parser for it, for some, looking at it? And the only reason we were able to get where we needed to go is that Heather had done a test data, right? She had taken notes of how she did it and what actions she took, and then she took that extraction out with all the access to the data, and now we can make proper interpretations. And that's important because it's not the same thing to say, look, I'm looking at something or an extraction from a device where I do not know how it got there. Well, I don't know the user actions. And you can make wrong conclusions because you don't know how they came to be, right? Now, based on that, Heather knew the process, we were able to get where we needed to be. And I'll mention a little bit later in the show an example of me making, I say mistake, but it's me dealing with limited data. So I did a parser for Aleap for Gmail emails, and it works great. There's no problem. Well, if you happen to have more than one Gmail account in the app, tied to the app, the tooling only parses one, and that's it. What about the other two? Mm-hmm. Well, the coding was not multi-account aware. So a good contributor, you know, a person from the community, and I will mention a bit later, sent me a pull request. Pull request means data to be added to the platform to fix that issue, right? So therefore, then we can parse as many as we need, right? Well, why did I make that mistake? Because my data set only had the one account, right? And that, again, that speaks of you creating that test data and working some more of that. And before I let you chime in on that, let me just put in Kevin. Kevin is one of the maintainers with me, one of the, you know, my right-hand person. And he says that he will catch up with some of those. Like, he promises. So he'll be updating those.
Everybody will be waiting for you, Kevin.
Again, what are you doing here? You know, go get yes. So like last show. Get go coding, man.
Don't have time for this. So I love this blog by Hexordia. Prior to that, still in conjunction with that, I mm-hmm. use Chris Vance. He had put out a blog about the same process, but also for iOS and Android. So the blog is entitled Setting Up a Testing Lab of iOS and Android Devices. And there's a great walkthrough of the process of preparing a test phone in that blog as well. Excellent resource.
You got to have your test phones. If you're Android, maybe if you don't have a test phone available, maybe do a virtual machine with Android on it. There's guys on doing that. If you have money to burn, then you can get Corellium for iOS, but I don't think anybody does.
It's really expensive, like, right?
Yeah, it is expensive. but, you know, either way, get your test data and make sure. Like, looking at protobufs is something that I've been talking about a lot lately, and we'll mention in the show a little bit more. You need to know the context. You say, okay, this is the device that came from my investigation. This is great. I have the data. I'm going to try to replicate some of that data on my test device, or just create data and see what are the similar, how similar they are, so I can get to the proper conclusions, right? It's essential that we start doing that.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I have a couple of test devices, Android and iOS, and I bought them on eBay for pretty cheap used devices that people were selling. So you can find them out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And a quick note, if we're going to put all the show notes, all the URLs that you see on the screen, the show notes, if for some reason you cannot pull them up, because I think in YouTube there's a little icon there that's getting in the way, don't sweat it. We're going to go put in the show notes, either both in YouTube and at the digitalforensicsnow.buzzsprout.com, right?
Yep.
Yeah, site. You can go to the episodes there and you can see the notes, see the URL. So don't sweat it. Don't try to copy them now.
Yeah, no, we will definitely provide them. So there are a ton of conferences and trainings and just some opportunities for learning coming up. So we're going to just talk about some of those now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So which one we have first here?
So the Paraben Forensic Innovation Conference is the first one. And it's a free virtual conference. There's multiple dates for this. So when you go take a look at the website for this, there's multiple one-day events. And it focuses on issues in digital forensics, open source intelligence, and other things that cyber professionals may be dealing with.
So Amber, you know, the CEO and president, she's awesome, and I can assure you that her events are really, really worth your time.
And then here's the link to that. And then another opportunity that is coming up, this one's for some training. We had talked previously about Belkasoft putting on a free iOS training. They're now doing the same thing, but for Android. So with the Belkasoft training, you'll get a 30-day trial license of Belkasoft. Training materials, video tutorials, pre-recorded webinars that you can watch, articles, and then there'll be some practical tasks that you perform during this training, and you'll receive a certificate of completion and achievement, and the successful completion in the course will also, you'll earn 6 CPE credits for that. And they also had a bonus for this one, certificate recipients will get a discount on their next purchase of Belkasoft. So if anybody's a Belkasoft user and or wants to become a Belkasoft user, if you take this free training, it looks like you'll get some sort of discount on the next purchase. I don't know if it's for training or if it's for the tools, but you'll find out when you go sign up for the free training.
No, absolutely. And Belkasoft, the we were able to do the iOS one, and it was really good. So
yeah, I thought it was really good too.
Yeah, so I think it's worthwhile. Also, the CPEs, I think more organizations should do something like that, right? Like, hey, look, here's some CPEs, because one thing that as forensic examiners, you know, we all know, we need to keep up with so many certifications, right? And those certifications have some, you know, continuing education credits they need to put in. So having these and be able to knock those out, that also helps a lot. So it's well done by Belkasoft.
Yeah, and that's free from February 26th through March 26th. So make sure you go get registered and learn all you can about Android.
Yeah, get him while it's free. It's the best cost point there, price point.
Yeah,
free.
Definitely. I love it. Definitely. Yeah, so after March 26th, it'll be a paid course.
Yeah, so go with free. You can't go wrong with free.
And then other events that are coming up here.
Yeah, so which one? We have the Cellebrite one, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so Cellebrite is, you know, they're coming out. We discussed it, I think, last show or the show before. The case to closure concept, where they're renaming their tools or adding in it some sort of family branding, good stuff. So they're also coming with a case to closure summit. And the summit is going to be from August 5th to the 8th in D.C., Washington, D.C. So there'll be, Cellebrite expert lead sessions in regards to training, and you can talk to other examiners. The CEO is going to be speaking there. And they actually have a call for papers. I think it's either it came out or it's going to come out. So if you want to participate, you know, submit your proposal, and you might be able to present. You know, I would love to submit, but it's a travel. I'm a little bit far away, but we'll see what happens. And and you know, if you get selected, you can go there and really participate and be part of that community. Yeah. Another thing they're doing that I think it's nice is they're doing what they're calling the Digital Justice Awards. And and there's a link there. And let me see if I can bring up, put on the screen the website for it. So let me select here. There we go. So the awards, as you can see here, there's different categories. Before I go into the categories, some of them can be you can go and submit people to be, you know, to be considered for these awards. So if you go scroll down the page, where is it? Actually, it's right here. It's right in my face. All right. So you see on the right here, you put your name, you know, who you are, email, some information. Obviously, they want to validate, you know, this is a legit submission. And you can select the category there that you want to submit somebody to be considered for. And then you put why and all that. So what are the categories? Well, you got case of the year. So, you know, it talks about case that had a broad impact, you know, in the society or the community that you can speak of. And, you know, so it doesn't have to be only law enforcement. It could be a case, you know, in the private sector. That's fine as well. They have the Community Guardian Award. And these are folks that are, you know, programs or campaigns that help with public safety, right? Obviously, in the realm we are. There's the Digital Bridge Builder Award. So folks that, you know, foster collaboration. So that's a pretty nice one. What's the other, Heather? Do you have them on screen?
I do. So a Voice of Voiceless Award, or Voice for the Voiceless Award. Mm-hmm. So a voice to the victims through digital forensics. Mm-hmm. Great category to have. Mentor of the Year. So if you have somebody who's mentoring you, a great mentor, put them in for this award. There's the Diversity and Inclusion Champion.
Yep.
And Design Partner of the Year. I believe that one is if you're involved in the Design Partner Program. So if you're an active participant in the Cellebrite's Design Partner Program, if you don't know what that is, you can join their Design Partner Program and become a beta tester for the upcoming versions of their tools that are coming out. So you'll try them first and provide feedback from your beta testing.
Yep. And we have, what else? We have the Racing Star Award. Mm-hmm. So folks that are newcomers into the field. And then we have the Excellence in Digital Forensics Award, right? So, yes. You know, it's a person or a group of people that are really have a track record of doing great work in this field. Now, I will say something I like about these awards is that a couple of categories, they say, I'm sorry, I'm going up and down the screen there. Hopefully nobody's dizzy. Celebrate Select. So they have a combination of kind of community-led awards and some they actually, you know, they have an internal committee, I would assume, that will select the person to be recognized. And that's something that I like because a lot can be gained, I should say, by the consensus of the folks that vote, right? Or public opinion. But not always, right? Not just because the majority votes for something doesn't mean that something is the best.
Right.
Right?
That's true. So
I like a balance. I like to hear what the community says, but I also like to, you know, have a group of people say, hey, look, these are worthwhile in their own right. And that's more, this type of awards are important because recently the SANS Forecast Awards have completed. It had a really long run. Do you know how many years? I would say
Oh my God. Yeah, I have no idea. A lot.
Yeah, I want to say a decade, but I don't know. Maybe somebody in the chat knows. So for those that are not familiar, SANS, you know, had the Forecast Awards and they were all community led in the sense that the community would nominate people, the top three or four, depending on the category, top three or four nominees will be put into vote again to the community. And Lori says they were since 2009. Quite a while.
Yeah.
And, wow. And then, you know, whoever the community voted first, then they would win. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to be nominated a few times and the tooling's been nominated a few times and it's great for awareness, but now it's done. So it's not a thing anymore. And other type of awards in this field, hopefully can fill the space. And I say this because I think most in terms of awareness, this type of awards, the big benefit for me is that makes me aware of the work other people are doing, people that I should be following them or trying to see what they're going on and kind of helps create the broader culture. It's not the culture, the digital forensics culture, just that's not what the awards are, but it helps foster more of that community and DF culture that we're trying to establish, even with this humble little show, trying to create content that speaks to our interests. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. Let me take that down. All right. Another event coming up is the Magnet Virtual Summit. So that runs from February 27th to March 7th. And it's a summit where people can go and share and obtain digital forensics knowledge. I think there's over 60 presenters in fields such as mobile forensics, e-discovery, malware, ransomware, video forensics, you name it, they cover it with over 60 presenters. So that's a great virtual summit to join as well. Also free. So that's always a plus.
Yeah, no, yeah. And do you have a picture there for the summit by any chance?
I do. Let me open it up here. I would have forgotten here.
No, I definitely want to show, I want people to see the picture there. Yeah, so I want to show folks this picture because the summit is not only in English. They'll also be, I think, in Spanish and maybe also in Portuguese. And what you're seeing here is, you know, Magnet Virtual Summit, because they have the summit in person and a virtual summit also kind of running, you know, during those days. And I'm hoping that Heather could read that for us in Spanish.
I am not reading that for you. I do not speak Spanish and I will butcher it. But you should read it in Spanish.
All right. I'll read it. I'm just messing with you. All right,
says, I know.
Estoy orgulloso de presentar en Magnet Virtual Summit 2024. And what that means is I'm proud to present in Magnet Virtual Summit 2024. And I have that because I'll be presenting in Spanish about SecB files. right? In iOS and macOS devices. So if you know folks or you yourself are also a Spanish speaker, you can come listen to that in Spanish. So I'll be participating in doing that. See, I have some Spanish speakers in the chat. They're volunteering to read it. Too late. I read it.
Oh, you could have stepped in for me. Thank you.
There you go. The chat has your back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So check those out. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, definitely check it out. I think it's really awesome that you're going to be presenting.
Yeah, there's a need for this type of content, I believe, in Spanish and in many other languages. And I wish I had a little bit more time to do some of that. Maybe, hopefully, for next year. Yeah. Because, you know, the forensics community in the United States, right? Maybe we can expand and make that community even larger by creating some of that content in Spanish. So we'll see if we can work on that throughout the later half of the year after we're done with IASIS.
Yeah. Wait till we're done with that. Magnet is also going to be doing their Capture the Flag during this time. If nobody has ever done a Capture the Flag, they are so awesome to learn about new artifacts and really sharpen your skills, but so frustrating when you can't find the artifacts that they're asking you to find. But I highly suggest any of the Capture the Flag from any of the companies that put these on, because it really, really does sharpen your skills in digital forensics. The register date is by February 28th, and then the images and the download links will be available March 1st for that.
Yeah, and it's always a good CTF, the ones that Magnet puts up. I think Jessica Hyde and some of the Exordia crew were instrumental in building that CTF. So it's gonna be a good time. So and look, at least you can be safe, because Kevin says that he won't be playing. So at least you know there's a chance for you to go to first place, since the king of the CTFs is not participating.
Oh, come on, Kevin. We're not going to create a team like we did for the Celebrite one where you carry us.
Carry us, fed us, put us in bed, woke us up, you know, totally pushed us ahead. No, I think Kevin can participate because he is part of the kind of set up the thing up, and he'll be teaching on that and on that, those topics as well. So,
okay.
Yeah, he's on the... producing side this time around.
Okay, gotcha. So we have no team. I don't know how we'll do, just me and you.
We'll play as anonymous. They don't know it's us.
There you go.
So go CTFs. And again, and we're talking about CTFs without saying what it is. It's Capture the Flags. Or maybe we did. It's on the screen. You know, but the point is, even if you're new, don't be afraid. There's nothing, you know, you just learn. You go there.
Yeah.
And Jessica told me that there's challenges of all, full expertise levels. So if you're a beginner, there'll be some flags that you can definitely build and work on. If you're an expert, there'll be flags for you as well. And the point is not winning. I mean, it is, but the main point is learning, right? So winning is the point, and the bigger point is learning. So go check it out.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about... shift gears a little here and talk about a new gadget that has come out that is not released yet, I don't believe, but it has to do, well, it's called Rabbit R1. It does not replace your smartphone. Let me put a picture up. I'll explain what it is here. Okay. There we go. So it's a little gadget that is a standalone AI device that works with the applications that you have on your phone. So it is, I don't believe it's released yet, but it's $199. And it's described as sort of a universal controller for your apps. One of the articles I read about it described it also as similar to Alexa or a Google Assistant. And it runs on Rabbit's own operating system, the Rabbit OS, and it can control your music. They say it can order you a car, it can buy your groceries, send messages, and more, all through one single interface. So I have to get one.
Can it?
Because I have to have to see how this works.
Can I write my reports at work?
It might write your reports. You have to get one. If I get one, we'll test that for you, right? We'll do our testing and validation on this device. But it sounds cool.
Yeah, I mean, and it's one of the more creative, I say creative, but I would say more of a the next step in AI usage. So what folks are seeing on the screen is a little almost square kind of block with a screen. It's smaller than a phone or an iPhone. And there's an iPhone behind it kind of for size comparison. I would say like half, maybe half, the bottom half of it, just thicker. Has a little camera that rotates from the back to and forth. And pretty much you talk to the thing and the thing does things for you. So this is based on what they call a large action model. What that means is that they taught their AI to be able to interact with the apps. This is different from Siri or Google that's kind of tied to the operating system, and you can only ask certain things from that operating system. This has this language model that interacts with apps. If you want to go to Instagram and get stuff from Instagram, you tell the rabbit, hey, I want to do this and this on Instagram, or whatever information that you're requiring or action you want it to do. Now, the first thing that came to my mind is, okay, so this rabbit thing is going to be kind of the middle person between the actions on the, you know, app API side versus and me, the user. So my question is, well, what is kept? Are those commands transactions kept somewhere? Is there any way to pull them from them? How will they look on the other side, right? On the, say, the Instagrams or LinkedIn or whatever interactions apps that does, how would that look? And how can we differentiate when an action is done straight by the user versus an action being middleman or middle person in the middle type of thing with the device, okay? Or AI in the middle. It's neither a man or a woman, it's an AI. So AI in the middle, right? And what legal repercussions could that have, right? Because it's not me pressing. I told the AI to do it. Can I claim later that, well, I told the AI to do this, but the AI misunderstood me. That's not what I actually wanted. And look what the AI did. Oh my goodness. You know, all that contraband is now on my device. How did that happen? The AI, you know, confused the words, right? Or look, you know, all that money got moved from one account to the other. And it's the AI that misunderstood me, right?
That's a really different version of the it wasn't me defense.
Yeah. Well, but even, I mean, it's like I see it like the whole, well, it wasn't me, it was a malware. And we know that 99.999% of the time is not true. But how do we know
that?
Because we have to go and show that it's not true, right? We got to show, no, look, that malware there is just there to show you apps or just to grab, you know, data so they can sell it, so they can put you better ads on your phone. So when you say, oh, I love a green car, all of a sudden your phone is showing you green cars, buy green cars all around, right? And that's the process. So I immediately think about what are the forensic artifacts and how's that going to impact my extraction of them, my understanding of them, and even the legal aspects when you put in these devices in the middle of the interaction. I think we're heading to a brave new world in regards to how we put the user behind the keyboard when an AI is kind of in the middle of the thing.
Yeah, definitely. I am really curious to see the same thing. And I think I am going to actually buy one. So be ready. We're going to be investigating this and adding support into the leaps to, right? To tell whether or not AI use it. We'll see. We'll see.
I can only hope. Yeah, and you know,
I'm going to put you to work.
Yeah, and you know, Abraham is saying like the AI pin is another wearable handheld too. And are you familiar with that one, Heather?
I'm not. I've never heard of it. That's why I threw the comment up, because I'm definitely going to go research that. I think others should too. Check it out. See what it has to offer.
Yeah, and I know a little bit. I mean, it's not the topic. It's going about the rabbit, but I'll bring it quickly, folks. I don't know. Literally, it's like a little device. It's smaller than the rabbit, and it's a pin. So you can put it like on your shirt. I think of it as a Star Trek communicator. If your Trek is here on the show, they go, computer, you know, whatever. So you talk to the thing responds to you. And if it wants to show you something, you put your hand out. It has a little projector so you can project whatever it is in your hand. So I guess the idea is for kind of liberate you from the endless scrolling of a, you know, of an iPhone-like brick phone device. Okay. So, but the interesting thing about the rabbit is that it's built on top of things that you already use. And that's what I find interesting, because the learning curve and the applicability of it seems to be something that's already easier to adopt. quick note, we haven't said it since the beginning. Neither the activities, training, products, software. We are not sponsored by anybody. We're not haters. We're also not shills, right? We just talk about things that we find interesting. So always keep that in mind. We're just talking about things that we find might be of use. Yeah. So there'll be a lot of changes in our work in regards to that. So yeah, Megan is saying in the chat that now I can act like I'm in Star Trek. It's okay, Megan. When I go to the supermarket, I believe I'm a Jedi. Whenever the doors open by themselves, so I feel you. I can open the doors with my mind.
Kevin says, hey, Rabbit, show me all the artifacts on you now. Export as a PDF. So it's going to do your reports for you right there. That's the command.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, if you're creative enough in your commands, you might get away with some of that. Hey, Rabbit, can you root yourself, please? Thank you. Yeah. So there's a lot of different, developments. Oh, one last thing I want to say. I've seen some early reviews and there's been some complaints with the Rabbit that it takes too long to respond. Of course, the idea and the execution are two different things. These things evolve, they're first generation products. But I do like this discussion because as an examiner, I need to be in the mindset of what's coming, around what's around the curve, right? And how I'm going to adapt. And that links to what I was talking about earlier about Annie Isley. She was doing her job, doing math by hand. And that was her job, right? There were some of them that were doing these calculations. And when computers came in, she could have said, well, guess what? I'm out of a job now. I'm outdated, But she saw around that curve and saw that these computers need to be programmed. These computers need to be properly instructed to do the things that we need them to do. And she evolved with the technology and became a programmer herself, and actually became even more essential to the work that NASA did during those times, and even to this day. So, always kind of emulate that thought process, and you will always be useful.
So, we also have an article here: AI fingerprints unique or maybe not. So, I'm going to let you take that one.
So, this is a really interesting article. And do you have it or do I have it?
I have the link. Would you like me to get it open up?
Yeah, please bring it up so they can the folks that are watching have a visual. So what is this article about? So for the longest, and I'm not a fingerprint expert, of course, I'm just going from what the news report states out. The general consensus is that all fingerprints are unique, right? And it's even the fingerprints from your own hands, right? So, we got 10 fingers or whatever fingers we have, and those fingerprints are distinct from each other, right? So one of the some students from a computer science class, they went out. I don't remember the university right now. Maybe you can scroll down and maybe find it. Not that it really matters for the discussion, but the point is this. They went and took a government, publicly available fingerprint database, and they trained their, large language model, the AI, on it. And what they discovered, this is interesting, is that you can determine with highly levels of success, even up to 77% success rates, that a fingerprint from one, say one hand, and another one from another hand, the AI could determine if those fingerprints belong to the same person. Does that make sense? Not that they're identical, but that they belong to the same person, right? And this is like, it was so shocking that when they try to release their report in some of the, journals, scientific journals, they're like, nah, this is bullcrap. This is impossible. Mm-hmm. We know that all fingerprints are unique. And what the research was saying is, look, you can tell two different fingerprints came from the same person. And you might ask yourself, why is this important? Well, imagine a case, a cold case, where you have fingerprints, but those fingerprints have no identical matching records in our fingerprint databases. What if we could take that fingerprint, run it through this AI, and then tell me, look, these other fingerprints that I have could be a match for that hand or that person that you're looking for, right? And this is important because the AI taught us something that we didn't know before. So this type of coding, right? It's not only implementing things that we know, it goes and discovers things that we didn't know. And what the researchers believe is happening is that the process to determine if fingerprints are identical to another is by how the curvature of the different, you know, the curvatures of each fingerprint, right? Well, this LLM is using a whole different way of calculating, not by the shape, but by different inferences within those shapes to get to that certain degree of certainty, which is pretty wild. Cases will be impacted by this technology. Even cases, because we always talk about hashes. Oh, they're like fingerprints. They're unique like fingerprints. Well, we might need to get a better example. Fingerprints might not be as unique as we believe them to be. Which, by the way, I always thought the fingerprint example is kind of weak because a hash is way, 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 way more unique than a fingerprint, right? Extremely more. Even hashes that have known collisions, like MD5s, which is kind of like, you know, small length, you know, and it's not variable length, it's kind of fixed length. Let me explain that to the folks. If you have a hashing algorithm which says, okay, I'm going to take this piece of data, pass it through the algorithm, and get a unique identifier of this data, only that data will generate this unique value. If you have two pieces of data that generate the same unique value, that's a collision. That's a problem because now it's not uniquely identified. Well, if you have a fixed value at the end of the process, fixed means that it's whatever, 16 bits long, 28 bits long, 128 bits long. You, by logic, pure logic, at some point, you're going to get a collision, right? Because let's say if you can only identify uniquely 10 trillion things, the thing 10 trillion and one is going to be a repeat of that set, right? Makes sense, right, Heather?
Yeah, makes sense. Absolutely.
Right. Now, the question is how likely it is to have a collision of two things within that hashing algorithm and how likely that is. Well, it's extremely unlikely. It's right. So extremely unlikely that fingerprints are way, way more likely to repeat identically than a hash value. So we always compare it to fingerprints, but it's a crappy comparison because hashes are way more unique. Even hashes that have they have collisions, but kind of manufactured collisions, right? Not collisions in the wild. And when I say in the wild, I mean collisions not generated in a lab, right? So, you know, we need to get some better examples in how unique some of our work is and how precise some of the calculations are, and also how imprecise they can be, right? When we talk about, you know, we talk about fixed length output algorithms, for example. So just being honest with ourselves and with the field.
I'm going to have to come up with a new analogy. I use the fingerprint one quite often, actually.
I'm being a little bit pedantic. I won't deny it because for a jury is
so
good.
Relatable. Yeah, it's relatable.
They know what a fingerprint is. So I'm not poo-pooing that like that. I'm talking more of in the examiner world, right? Ourselves in the field.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. Use your fingerprint example at court every day. That works.
They'll know what you mean.
but among ourselves, we can definitely kind of, you know, whoever drinks, and I take my Diet Coke, and we can do some philosophy on how can we come up with better analogies.
Take this down.
Yeah. So technology is going to, this AI technology is going to permeate all the stuff we do. And not only in digital forensics, you know, in the broader tech world, so much that the fears that folks are going to get fired because they're not needed, because AI is taking their place. And actually, that's a prediction that's actually coming true. We have an article, right?
Yes.
From The Verge. And we have to evolve with this technology. Some of the work that we do, if your work can be easily, is this a work that's repeatable and easy to quantify? It's easy to automate, and especially with an AI, right? And there might be more of that. So I think us that we're in the field of digital forensics, we won't see that immediately because at the end of the day, an AI cannot go to court and testify, right?
Right.
We need a person to actually validate that. But it will mean that there will be less people within the field as we're used to. Might. I don't know. We don't really know. So the question is, how can we look ahead of that curve and figure out how can I be still usable, right, or service in a world where AI is taking part of that, repeatable work for us? Right?
Yeah, I think there will be less eventually, less employees needed, but you're always going to need the human element, in my opinion, for the digital forensic field. Have to have somebody to check that data, make sure the AI is correct, and present it in court, like you said.
Yeah. Jared's in the chat saying he loves the new background. And I put that and I put that up because I'm gonna take down the thing.
Yeah.
I'm gonna show, see if I don't know how to even show the background only. Oh yeah. Well, the background was done by an AI, model.
Oh, so it goes perfectly with these topics.
Yeah. So I just said I want DFN and I kind of described how I wanted it and the AI did it for me. So it definitely goes with it. Now we need to figure out how we're going to be relevant in this field and, just keep your eye on that. Super important.
Yeah. So there was an article that came out by Luca, and I'm going to butcher his last name. So I'm just going to put the link up because his name is in the link.
I'm going to make my best Italian impression.
You want to try it? Okay.
Cadonici. But ooh, I could be wrong.
I bet you're right. He did a blog recently and put it up on LinkedIn. So if anybody doesn't follow him on LinkedIn, he has some really good information that he puts out on LinkedIn. I would highly suggest following him. But he talks about a hidden gem in iOS 17. So it's a passcode reset that lets you use the old passcode temporarily if you forget your new passcode. So when a user, when users alter their passcodes in iOS 17, the passcode reset provides a 72-hour window during which the old iPhone passcode or iPad passcode remains valid for accessing the device. So the way it works is on your lock screen, you input the passcode 5 times until you get the unavailable. And then you tap forgot passcode at the bottom and select enter previous passcode. Enter the old passcode and follow the on-screen steps to set up a new passcode. So how could this benefit us in the digital forensics world, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I can definitely see the use of the old passcodes. I don't know how many gray key users there are out there, but the old passcodes can be utilized for unlocking other devices, right? If old passcodes are in there, it may give you an additional chance of accessing the device that you currently have.
Oh, absolutely. And we have to use all the tools in the toolbox. We can always try to guess, and Geraldine is so good at it; it's just ridiculous. She's like, I figured out what the birthday of this thing. If I combine it with something else, let me try. Oh, it opened. So she's awesome with that. But if you have access to be able to, old passwords, you can definitely kind of build yourself into. Because for example, let's say, well, I have this old password. Actually, this old password doesn't work with the computer, but it works with the email. For example, I'm kind of making a scenario up, right? Mm-hmm. Or some other system. And then you can get the information for the current password from that other system, right? Now, it's a made-up example. I'm not saying that you should go and log in illegally into somebody's email. I'm not saying that. But you can see yourself using that information in other systems, as legally applicable to get into the systems you need to get into, right?
Right. If they use that passcode once, they've used it on other devices, definitely. So
it's human nature, and it's a bad habit that we all have. Yeah. So actually, before we jump totally away from the topic, because Christopher was saying that my LinkedIn profile is AI generated, right? And I'm like, let me see if I can.
I'm gonna have to go check that out. Are you showing this?
Well, I'm going to show mine, not his.
Okay.
No, I'm not going to show his without permission. So
I'm going to go check it out after.
So, well, the point with that is that, even something as simple as showing your face, I did not want, and I cannot get to the picture. Hold on. Just bear with me for a second, folks. There we go. So I did not want to go and get, there we go. I did not want to go to a professional photographer and take time to do that. So what I did was I fed the AI a whole bunch of pictures of me, and it came out with that. Obviously, I look better in the AI than I look in real life. But look, as long as it's similar enough to me, you know, it's actually, you know, on the profile, it's kind of smaller, so people can, you know, they won't be like those dating sites. So you're like, oh, you know. You go in person, you're like, are you the same person on the picture? Was that picture taken 20 years ago? Yeah, you don't want to be that person. So no, it's similar. It's close enough to me that it can pass as me, but it's all AI generated. So yeah, Christopher, yeah, I feel you.
my LinkedIn picture is also an AI generated. I look all professional in that picture. they really did a good job fixing me up. I might as well use it.
Exactly. I mean, not that you would, but you know, don't use it on dating sites, right?
No.
Yeah. All right. So sorry about that. I had to make that comment because I use AI on my profiles as well. So I'm with you, Christopher.
So another topic that we're going to discuss, Android Auto reboots. So there was recently an article, let me put the link up here, about Android Auto reboot. So the OS team is suggesting that Android should introduce an auto reboot feature to make exploitation of firmware flaws more difficult. I don't like hearing that, but
neither.
they tweeted, "We've recently reported firmware vulnerabilities that are being exploited by forensic companies to obtain data from devices that are not at rest. If device is at rest, it isn't relevant and data is safe. Our auto reboot feature is there to get devices back at rest automatically." So they point out that rebooting the device terminates all temporary states, processes, and activities that could be exploited and requires authentication like your PIN, passcode, biometric, or any other way to unlock the device. And it thereby re-engages all security mechanisms. Yeah, I mean, I don't like hearing that, but
I like how they use the terms at rest, right? When the phone is at rest versus, I guess it's awake, I guess is the other term. I don't know. Obviously, for that means BFU, AFU, right? Is it after first unlock or before first unlock? Mm-hmm. And again, folks like us, we've been doing this for a while. We know that if it's before first unlock, right? So you had the phone before it was the PIN code was accessed. You might get some data. It's going to be way more limited than you will get with after first unlock. If the person already put the PIN code and it locked again, but at least it was unlocked once, you will get some more. And again, you get different levels of access if you have the whole passcode versus not having it, and depending on the tool that you're using. The point is this, at least from my perspective, is if phones are going to start rebooting themselves after a certain amount of time just to get them out of AFU to go back to BFU, just to make quote-unquote more secure, then that means that when you get that phone, you can't just sit on it. You can't be like, well, I'll work on this in 2 days extractions will then go into the priority list, and the parsing part, not that it's not priority, but we have to wait or establish a mechanism where we're constantly attending to these to get those extractions and another process to then look into how we parse this in a timely manner. But it just tells us that it informs me of what my priority is going to be and what's going to be at the top of that list.
Yeah, definitely. So we have come to what's new with the leaps. And there are a few new things with the leaps. One, Metadata Forensics wrote a parser for the leaps, and it's for the Siri Remember SQLite database. So that database is a combination of Biome and Interaction C. And the new iLeap artifact parses messages, calls, and media. So I'm going to share my screen and show what that looks like in iLeap.
And again, free open source tool. You can get it to parse your mobile devices. And Cher's going to show us this new artifact. It was brought by Metadata Forensics, correct?
Yes.
So thank you, Metadata Forensics, to also contributing to the community and putting that research out and usable for everybody. So we thank you immensely. Thank you.
So the artifact you want to run is called Siri Remembers, and it calls, media, and messages were in this this extraction. And let me just One second. So this is a look at what the calls look like for this artifact in iLeap. And then I didn't have a media file available. And then messages in this artifact. So it gives you the timestamp, recipient, the recipient handle, sender, the direction of the messages, the application bundle ID that the message is coming from, and the UUID that the message is coming from, as well as some other data related to the messages.
No, and that's great for that pattern of life when all data points are not available. At least you got something you can build on, because if you don't have the message from this end, this database can tell you that, well, you know what? There might be a copy somewhere else, right? And right. Data is like that. Data is like rabbits. I'm talking about rabbit a second ago. if you have a message, it's going to, you know, that you have on your text message, you send it to another phone. Now there's a copy on the other phone. And when that person forwards says, hey, look what this guy said or this gal said, and forward, now you have that message on a third phone, but it's not only on the third phone. It multiplies because now there's a cloud backup of those devices. So now that message is in three different cloud backups somewhere else, right? And if you go around and even within the phone, it might be a link to that in a knowledge C database or a SegB format within Protobuf. Like data likes to replicate uncontrollably, right? And it's our job to be aware of what places are those? Where are these replications happening? So we can get to them whenever one of the spots we're kind of used to getting the data firsthand is not available anymore. So our job is also be aware of where the stuff could be replicated as we're moving forward. And that applies to emails, documents. You think about it digitally. Just name it. There will be a copy somewhere else. You just need to figure out where they are hiding.
And I think you're going to talk about some other things that are new with the leaps.
Oh, absolutely. So let me see here. So recently, I don't have an image to show folks, so I discovered verbally because we had some requests from partner law enforcement agencies from overseas to say, hey, look, now notifications in iOS went from, in iOS 17, from being housed within a SegB version 1 format to SegB 2 format. And they were asking, is there a way to update that? So thanks to, again, CCL Solutions and their code, I took some time and I updated that. So now you can go and get those notifications running through iLeap, and then you'll get the messages out from those SegB version 2 files. It was really, and again, I cannot show you because we use case data for that. So obviously we cannot share that. But the cool thing about it, which is why I love this field so much, we discovered in the process that there's another data type within the SegB files that we need to consider. So we talked to Alex Caithness, and we talked about how that goes. And he was able to update the code to take in consideration all those new data types. So it's pretty exciting. There's always something new to be learned. So you want to check that out. So we got that available. Notifications, SegB2, which, by the way, you're thinking, who cares about notification? Let me tell you, if you have a message coming in and you get a notification, the text, sometimes the full text of it is inside the communication. If the person goes and deletes the message, that notification is hanging out, because where do you go to delete notifications? I mean, you can swipe them to enough for them not to be right there, but the notification, there's no delete notification button, right?
Right.
Just you can swipe them away and that's it. So this is going to be there. So you'll be surprised of, again, another place, because data wants to replicate. They're like bunnies, right? Another place. If you don't have it on the database for that chat or that SMS, go look at notifications. Maybe it's hanging out there. So now we have support for that. So I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, that's that. Awesome. I think he updated the script in record time too, right?
Oh, in a matter of, come on. You know, Alex, he's a freaking genius. So yeah, it took him like, he's like, oh yeah, that's silly. Done. Yeah. So we have those. And like I mentioned before, and let me look that up. I want to share the name. Patrick Dela, he was able to update Ailey, which is for Androids. Also open source tool, free. You can go get it. And we'll provide the links in the show notes as well. And now you can take Gmail database, the big top data thing, .db. And if there's more than one, now it you can have different reports for each and every one of them, which is, again, super useful. And that's with tooling. Tooling, it constantly evolves. And that's why you need to use multiple tooling. You can have a tool that shows you 1,000 messages and another that shows you 2,000 messages. We had an example. We're not going to share it here, but we had an example of that this week, right?
Yeah.
And you need to have multiple tools. You need to be able to manually check stuff out. I mentioned, I think, last episode, you have a SecB file. What if Apple drops a new SecB file? Then what, right? You need to be kind of aware if you're not finding something that you expect to be finding. Be aware of all the data could be hiding and see if you can find it. It's like a big treasure hunt every day and we get paid for it.
It absolutely is. I love finding new data too that nothing's supporting. And then of course, passing it off to all of you guys that can write the artifacts for it. I'll find it for you. You write the scripts.
You know what? After IASIS, I'm just going to prod you to finish the Python class.
Yeah.
So you can start building some. Oh, I will. I should, and I will.
I know you will. So that brings us to everybody's favorite part of the show, like the meme of the week. Let me get that shown on the screen.
Meme of the week, you know, that means, you know, fireworks. Yay.
Right. And so hearts, very nice. Valentine's Day is coming up.
And we love the meme of the week, so we need some hearts, some reaction hearts here on my profile here. All right, what do we have?
So the meme of the week has two people that are arguing, and the text reads, "There are some priority cases coming in. You already gave me 10 priority cases yesterday. And then all of today's cases are also priority cases. If all cases are priority cases, no case is a priority case. And I assume it's the boss at the end yelling, do the priority cases first." I am 100% that everybody that's listening to this can relate completely to this meme. Every case that comes in is a priority.
I like this meme because it's the guy from the, I think it's LA Choppers show. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like a father and son team, and people come to make custom bikes, and the whole show is hilarious because they're always arguing, right? And they scream at each other, but you know, they love each other, of course. And this back and forth, it's just real life. You know, again, I'm not saying it happened to me. It might not. You know, I'm going to preserve deniability on the specifics of this meme. But it's true, right? If you're listening to this, right, and you're in charge of managing a digital forensics outfit, right, are you just assigning stuff because somebody says it's a priority and you just assign it and forget it, right? Orange County Chopper, there we go. That's the, not LA. I guess Orange County is in California. It's close enough. But you can't. And look, I understand. Maybe the three cases, or like Christopher's saying, maybe the three cases in the chat, there are priorities for sure. But what does that mean? Just because they're priority, stating this is our priority, doesn't mean it's just going to happen, right? It's like like the office. I declare bankruptcy. That's not how it works. Resources have to come behind that. If you're not providing your team with the resources to handle the priorities, then they're not priorities. They're just cases that are coming in and they'll be worked as humanly possible, right?
Right.
If you're burning your people, burning the candle on both ends all the time, then you have a problem. If heroics have to save the day every day, then the process is flawed. There's a lack of resources or a lack of organization. I don't know what it is, but it's your job as the manager to be a force multiplier. What that means is you're there to help produce more in an easier, faster way. It doesn't mean you're just gonna, you know, whip people to get more work out of them. Or become an examiner, because at that point you're not a multiplier, you're an addition. You're another examiner in the team. So you're adding, but you're not multiplying. Multiplying is look at how I can get those resources, people, processes. So we go from having a little to exponentially grow our output as needed. So think of yourself as a multiplier. If you're managing these things, think of yourself as a multiplier. And you can apply that as an examiner. Think of yourself also as a multiplier. How can I automate my processes? How can I line up my tools to be able to get the most output, the most analysis done with the resources that I have allocated as I wait for more?
Yeah, definitely.
Does that make sense, Heather?
It definitely makes sense. I don't know how many other people get this too, but it's whichever case investigator or case manager or whatever is screaming the loudest about the case. It automatically seems to become a priority. It just can't.
I mean, I understand if the chief comes down and says, this is the priority. Okay, well, that's the priority, right? But right. So that's okay. But the chief is not coming down and say, here's 100 priorities, right? We use common sense. If the chief says it, then we do it, of course. But as a manager, we need to make sure that we think about these things. And our job is not just passing the buck. It's actually being force multipliers. And I think that's kind of a good thought to kind of close the show. How can we force multipliers for good in work, in life, in society, in all things that we do? So.
All right.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank again, everybody that's been in the chat. Thank you for your comments. You made the chat and lively and made the show lively. So we thank you. For the folks that are listening or watching later, we also thank you for taking the time to be part of the community. Do send us in our LinkedIn page or look us up there or by name. Send us your ideas. Send us your questions. Send us your suggestions. You can be candid. Also try to be kind at the same time.
I won't take offense to anything.
But be kind though. Yeah. and we will try to kind of reflect the things that are important to you and reflect them on the show. So Brett, I gotta put this in because this Brett is somebody that I respect immensely. So thank you so much for saying that we're the best D4 podcast. That's high praise.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I appreciate it, my friend. All right, and any last words for the good of the order, Heather?
That's it. Thank you so much for tuning in.
All right, everybody. So we're gonna come back in 2 weeks. And we'll we'll see each other then. So
yes.
See you later, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.